Welcome to Oncology Today, Oncologic Management of Gastroesophageal Cancers, a special program focused on recently published and emerging clinical research. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Daniel Catanacci from the University of Chicago Medical Center and Biologic Sciences. In addition to this audio podcast, there's also a video component with Dr. Catanacci's presentation. To begin, I asked him to discuss the role of immune checkpoint inhibitors in patients with advanced gastroesophageal cancers related to tumor location and histology.
The way I simply think about it is that there's three tumor types. There's esophageal squamous cell, there's the G-junction esophageal adenocarcinomas, which includes the distal esophagus, G-junction, and the proximal stomach cardia, or the so-called type 1, 2, 3 tumors as a second group, and the third group of stomach cancer proper. And if you really want to simplify it, because ultimately in the clinic, we really just call them squamous or adeno, that is the simplest way to approach the problem.
So, in other words, squamous, it really doesn't matter where the location.
Right. I mean, when you get into the neoadjuvant part of it, if it's a proximal squamous up in the cervical esophagus, surgery is not typically done because it's difficult to get there. And so they're different. But other than that, biologically, no, they're the same.
Okay. So, yeah, and I'm just really thinking, I know there's a lot of local issues and all, but I just kind of focused again on checkpoint inhibitors. So if a physician is out there trying to consider a checkpoint inhibitor, maybe that's the beginning of how to look at it, adeno or squamous. So another question would be, what kind of assay to do for PD-L1? And does it change the type of assay you do, change based on the situation or the type of cancer?
That's a great question. And there's that table I showed for that purpose, is that what we know is that the combined positivity score, which includes not only the tumor cell staining, but also infiltrating leukocytes, is critical. That's what has shown predictive benefit when you look at that compared to a TPS or tumor positivity score only. So you would want a CPS score, and you would want to have a cutoff of at least one, if not higher. And we're learning that the higher the level, the better.
But again, CPS score for when you're considering any checkpoint inhibitor?
Yeah, so it gets a little bit complicated there. And so just as we know, the current approvals today, as we sit here, are for CPS 1 or higher in the third line setting of the adenocarcinomas for pembrolizumab. That's one approval. And in the second line setting for squamous cells of 10 or higher for pembrolizumab. But of course, we have an approval of nivolumab in all comers in second line squamous cells. And that's a function of the fact that the nivolumab study, Attraction 3, did not even look at CPS scoring. It just looked at all comers and was approved based on that.
But again, now we have some new data with nivolumab. What was the partner assay? And is that the one you need to use if you're thinking about nivolumab?
Yes. And so the new assay, which was the 28-8 antibody, which is different than the one that's currently FDA approved for Pembro, which is the 2-2-C3 antibody. This was the first study, this CheckMate 649 in the first line setting, to even look at CPS scoring in any of the CheckMate or Attraction studies. And as we can probably see when the data are shown, is that it will show benefit in the 5 or higher, far more substantial than the less than 5 group. So the answer to your question is yes. If you're going to be considering nivolumab, to use the CPS score of 5 or higher with the companion diagnostic that's going to be approved with it, which is 28-8.
So another sort of global macro question before we start to drill down on these new data. What about MSI testing? I assume you're going to do it, but if they're MSI stable, does that change how you look at things? And if they're MSI high, how do you approach it?
Right. And so there is overlap with these biomarkers. So MSI high is only about 3% of stage 4 disease. But we also know that like 90% or more are PD-L1 positive, at least by the cutoff of CPS 1 or higher. So if you were using the 1 score, you're going to capture your MSI highs anyway. 5 or higher, you know, you'll have some patients might be negative for that. So we are going to recommend to continue to check for MSI high in the event that you might have a PD-L1 negative MSI high tumor. But the vast majority of MSI high tumors are going to be PD-L1 positive by CPS 5 or high score.
just to sort of push MSI high to the side, at least in metastatic disease, if you have a patient who has MSI high disease, what line therapy are you thinking about, immunotherapy, and what kind of immunotherapy?
So I mentioned that because all the data in aggregate have, even though it's a low sub-incident group, we always see that they derive substantial benefit from immunotherapy, these MSI high tumors. And it doesn't matter which one of the anti-PD-1 or anti-PD-L1 agents. And so now with CheckMate 649 showing it yet again in the first line setting and clearly on the forest plot way off to the left with a hazard ratio of 0.33, the recommendation will be to use this immediately at newly diagnosed first line setting. And it'll be encompassed in the approval for nivolumab in the first line setting because they're going to be mostly positive by CPS 5 or higher score, as I mentioned. So it'll be indicated in the first line setting.
So moving on in terms of metastatic disease, again, can you talk about right now where we are in terms of introducing checkpoint inhibitors, which ones, and whether or not you see that changing based on recent data that's come out?
Yeah, and so the current standards are checkpoint inhibitors in the third line setting for microsatellite stable, adenos, or in the second line MSI high, or in the second line esophageal squamous. But in the very near future, we're going to expect, based on these first line studies, moving these into the first line setting in combination with chemo. And in the adenocarcinoma gastric, it's going to be very clear. There's only going to be one approval. It's based on CheckMate 649, and it's going to be nivolumab. In the squamous cells, at least for now, it's going to be very clear. It's only going to be based on Keynote 590, and it's going to be pembrolizumab, probably for 10 or higher, maybe even for patients that are all comers, but we have to see those data and subgroups that haven't been yet reported. The real challenge will be in the GE junction adenocarcinomas and esophagus adenocarcinomas, where there will be overlapped approvals because 649 and 590 both enrolled patients from that group of patients. And there will be an approval of FOLFOX plus Nevo for CPS 5 or higher. And there is very likely will be an approval of chemo plus pembrolizumab and CPS 10 or higher. And so in that setting, I think the consensus will be that the majority of physicians and patients will choose to use FOLFOX chemo over a cisplatin-based regimen. And they'll also be more likely to be positive if you use a CPS 5 cutoff versus 10. So I think that nivolumab is going to be sort of the clearer winner there in terms of that area where both will get approvals.
Is there a theoretical role for single agent checkpoint inhibitor in MS stable disease in patients who have high PD-L1, for example, Pembro with a level greater than 10, Pembro alone?
Yes. And so the data suggests that there are a subset of patients that will derive benefit compared to chemo with just single agent checkpoint inhibitor. But as I showed you those yin-yang plots, there's also patients in that group, even with CPS 10 or higher, that do worse than chemo. And so we need better selective biomarkers before we just embark on giving single agent immunotherapy compared to standard chemotherapy, where many patients are doing worse than the standard of care.
Can you talk a little bit about what we know about using checkpoint inhibitors earlier on, and maybe kind of chat a little bit about the CheckMate 577 study, how they did it, and kind of what you think it means for clinical practice?
Yeah, the CheckMate 577 study, which was the adjuvant study after curative intent chemoradiation, then surgery, and in those patients that had residual disease in the specimen, either in the primary tumor and or the lymph nodes, which we know are a poor prognosis, in other words, excluding those with a path CR, but also excluding the really high-risk patients with R1 resection. So taking the R0 high-risk patients, patients were randomized to the standard of care, which is nothing, or placebo, compared to nivolumab for a year in a 2-to-1 fashion. In those patients, the primary endpoint, the disease-free survival, was better in all comers, which was including both esophageal squamous tumors as well as esophageal adeno and G-junction adeno tumors. But when you look at the subgroup analysis in the forest plot of what's shown so far just by location, that the esophageal squamous tumors did far better, which we would expect. And we're waiting to see the breakdown of histology by CPS scoring to even show this even more clearly. So in terms of implications right now, we're really waiting to see, is this benefit really going to be seen in sort of the patients we see mostly, which are the G junction adenocarcinomas? And is it going to be in all of them, or is it going to be only in the ones with high level PD-L1? We need to see those data before we start acting.
So if we come to the point where we are going to start acting, do you think it's going to be incumbent to utilize this exact strategy the way it was done here with the neoadjuvant therapy and surgery? Or do you think it'll sort of bleed into a general adjuvant strategy of using nivolumab?
I think it's a good question, and it's hard to say what the general practitioners will start to do, but there's two sort of approaches, particularly in the adenocarcinomas of the esophagus and GE junction, where you can use neoadjuvant chemoradiation, then surgery, or you can use perioperative chemotherapy before and after the surgery. Bleeding into the perioperative chemotherapy is another suggestion that some may just start using that with FLOT, which is a standard of care. But we would caution against that too, because there's an ongoing study of FLOT with or without pembrolizumab in these GE junction tumors called KEYNOTE-585.
Are there trials looking at the idea of using an IO as maintenance after chemo, the way it was done in bladder cancer presented at ASCO with the Javelin avelumab study? Is that kind of strategy being looked at with GE tumors?
Yeah, it's been reported in one phase 3 study so far called Javelin 100. And that study was in patients who had chemotherapy for 3 months, and then they were randomized to continued chemotherapy or to avelumab. And that study, unfortunately, in all comers was negative. And also in TPS, the pre-specified correlative group was also negative, as expected. But the CPS group that they did in a retrospective analysis, of course, did show that the avelumab did better compared to the CPS patients that were positive with chemo. So it was a retrospective analysis, and so it doesn't lead to approval. This will sort of become moot, though, when there's approvals in the first-line setting. But before, as the first-line maintenance study, this study was interesting and could lead to benefit, at least in patients with high PD-L1 scores.
One of the things that you mentioned in your talk was the issue of Asian people doing better. Does that mean they derive more benefit from IOs? Is that what you're saying?
Even outside of IO, they do better in all of the studies that we run and that are global studies. When you look at the Vorce plot, they always have a better outcome compared to the non-Asian patients. And partly due to things that are understood and the things that aren't understood very well. One of the things that are understood very well is that Asian patients get more second-line, third-line, and later-line treatment, but there are other unexplained reasons. Then when you look at immunotherapy, there's also been a higher benefit in patients from Asia than non-Asian patients, higher response rates, higher progression-free survival, and better overall survival. Again, not clear why, but potentially some biologic mechanism. Maybe they have higher PD-L1 scores inherently because of their biology. This is not clear. But what we do see and observe is this consistent finding.
Let's talk a little bit about targeted therapy. And, you know, one thing that we've seen out there, of course, for a long time in HER2-negative gastric metastatic disease is the combination of paclitaxel and ramucirumab. And I'm curious what your thoughts were about the paper that you talked about in your talk at ASCO that was just presented looking at FOLFIRI in the situation rather than paclitaxel with ramucirumab. Can you talk about those data and kind of where you see that strategy fitting in?
I think that's an important data because on the front line, most of us use FOLFOX first line, and most patients get some element of oxaliplatin-related neuropathy. And so moving to second line with a backbone that is paclitaxel with more neurotoxic agent has always not been my favorite sequence. And so in a retrospective analysis that we did, where we looked at FOLFIRI with ramucirumab, the outcomes were very similar to what one might expect to paclitaxel and ramucirumab, and that led to it being listed in the NCCN guidelines. And then at ASCO this year, as you just pointed out, the Ramirez study shows a randomized study looking at this same thing. And as expected, there's no real major differences. And in fact, the claim is not that FOLFIRI ramucirumab is better than paclitaxel ram from an efficacy standpoint, but rather that it's just another option with non-overlapping toxicities to neuropathy. And also in patients, as I mentioned in the talk, who quickly recur after perioperative therapies, unfortunately that happens both with FLOT and carbopaclitaxel. Both have taxane regimen, both have platinum regimen. So why would you go with more taxane or platinum in the next line when they're recurring? FOLFIRI is the best choice. And so it's nice to have that option in the NCCN guidelines for these instances.
So it's an interesting, in non-small cell lung cancer, curbstrimucirumab is also used in the second line, but the trial there looked at docetaxel. And, you know, whenever I ask them, well, what about using paclitaxel? They don't want to do it because that wasn't the way the data was. And the general medical oncologists are going, we do that every day in gastric cancer. We know how to do it. We know it's better tolerated. But I think it's great that there's now another option, at least in gastroesophageal cancer. Any thoughts about what the nature of the synergy is? What do we see with Bev in a gastroesophageal? And why is it that we're not using that?
That's a great question, and the answer is that bevacizumab was never studied in the second-line setting or higher, whereas ramucirumab was in the REGARD and RAINBOW studies. Both of those agents, bevacizumab and ramucirumab, were studied in the first-line setting with the AVAGAST study for bevacizumab and the RAINFALL study for ramucirumab. Both of those studies, unfortunately, were negative in the first line. And the debate will go on why it's positive in the second line, whether it's some biologic characteristic or whether there's dilutional effect in later lines that you don't see. Irrespective, it's not standard to use in the first line setting.
Another thing I was curious about is the recent introduction of a TAS-102 to gastric or gastroesophageal. If you can talk about what you think about the data there, how, if at all, you use it and what clinical situations. And also in colorectal cancer, a lot of people now are using TAS plus Bev. Do we know anything about that in this situation?
Yeah, so that's the TAG study with trifluridine tipiracil, TAS-102, was in the third line setting or higher, but a half of those were in the fourth line setting or higher. And so it is really a late line option. And the benefit might be considered marginal, but they are better than nothing in patients who want to continue on and get some palliation. It's also oral. You take it for 5 days and then 2 days off, 5 days, then 2 days off, then 2 weeks off. So it's really not that much of an issue for them and generally well tolerated other than cytopenia. So, you know, I'll use it in at least in the fourth line setting and patients who've been through all the other sequence and there's really not a lot left. In some patients that are in the third line setting and they don't want to get an IV paclitaxel or irinotecan, oral agent is an option. So the big thing to recognize, though, is that in this country, only about 40 to 50% of patients get second line therapy and 30% or less get third line therapy and 15% or less get fourth line. So it's just not that common to get to that situation.
What about TAS-102 plus Bev and gastroesophageal? Do we have any data? Would you ever consider it?
Yeah, I know the data that are looking at that, say in colorectal cancer in the third line setting or higher, those data are not available, at least to date, for gastroesophageal cancer with Bev or with ramucirumab, but those types of studies are being planned and or are ongoing to see if they can synergize together in some way. And also even using it with irinotecan, TASIRI, it's been called in earlier lines of therapy.
Interesting. Let's talk about the increasingly interesting topic of HER2-positive disease, not just in gastroesophageal, but colorectal, breast, even, of course, now it's as the antibody-drug conjugate trastuzumab deruxtecan. Can you first maybe put in perspective where we were in general in the issue of HER2-positive disease, the measurement of HER2 in gastroesophageal cancer and utilization of anti-HER therapy before we got to trastuzumab deruxtecan? Where were we?
Yeah, we were basically very simple. This one's easy. It was only in first-line setting, trastuzumab plus chemotherapy based on the TOGA study, and that was based on IHC2 plus FISH positive or IHC3 plus, period. And that's where it was used, and when you fail that, you would funnel in as if you're a HER2 negative patient for second-line or later based on negative second-line studies, like I mentioned, Titan and Gatsby with lapatinib and T-DM1. Now this trastuzumab deruxtecan has been used in the third line setting and shows pretty remarkable benefit in those patients. Some things that I would caution, at least for now, are that that's a completely Asian cohort that are highly selected. More than half of them are in the fourth line setting or higher, which we, as I just mentioned, we don't see that here. So these are different patients than what we see. And so to jump and use this, say, an early second line setting, for example, where this study wasn't even used, compared to, say, our standard PAC-RAM, I think we have to just throw a little bit of caution and wait for these studies that are ongoing in the second line setting first before we jump to that. Now, in the third line setting, when there aren't a lot of great options, I think it's going to be a good tool to have in the toolbox. And whether or not that gets an approval here by the FDA, we'll see. But as we saw, there's a breakthrough designation for it here.
So it's really interesting to ask people with different levels of experience, background, like I say, you know, breast, pulmonary, et cetera, what they think about the potential pulmonary issues with this drug. Some people are very, very, very upset about it. Others are not too concerned. They say everything causes pneumonitis. Any take on it at this point about how much of a problem it is?
I think it all comes down to what are your other options at any given time point that you're going to weigh it against. In the third line or higher setting where you have nothing that works, patients are more than willing to take a 10% pneumonitis risk. However, that's why I pointed out earlier, like to move it to second line or even some people talking about first line, where you have good options that have good survival and that don't cause pneumonitis, you got to think twice before you're going to jump this and move it ahead until you really see that the downside of the pneumonitis is really outweighed by the benefit that you might get. But I've not seen that yet. So my take is in the third line setting or higher, great. That's a good tool to have. In the second line setting, I think we should wait for the currently ongoing DESTINY-Gastric4 study, which is comparing randomized to PAC-RAM, which is the current standard of care. And then if it's better, then it's better, and we can see. But I think we should wait for that before we start using it routinely in the second line setting, for example.
Yeah, I think that certainly is, you know, good thinking. And, you know, paclitaxel or amiseramab is a reasonable option, certainly can provide a lot of palliative benefit. I guess what I'm trying to figure out is just how much of a problem the pneumonitis really is. I mean, I know there's the initial report, but, you know, a lot of times once people find something out, they're more vigilant about it. Any sense about how it's going to shake out? I mean, so many things cause pneumonitis. Do you think this one's going to be worse than others, or you can't tell at this point?
I can't tell. And, you know, the other thing that we don't know yet is that is it more likely to occur in patients who've had a prior immunotherapy drug or not? Like these types of things we don't know, but it's very possible. And like you said, now that we're looking for it, maybe the incidence actually going to be a little higher than it was. But my impression will be that the majority will be low grade, 1 and 2, but still like pneumonitis requiring oxygen is still not good, especially when you have alternatives that don't cause that. So at this point, I think as we see more data, and like I said, that's why I would like to see a randomized head-to-head study looking at this in a second-line setting.
Any other anti-HER2 drugs that you ever consider using outside a trial setting other than trastuzumab? And now, you know, maybe trastuzumab, daratoxin. I've heard people talk about using pertuzumab, trastuzumab, pertuzumab, lapatinib. Do you use any of those things?
Yeah, I do. And so the long and short of it is, we know that pertuzumab was negative in the first line setting in the Jacob study. It didn't add benefit to chemo plus trastuzumab as it did in breast cancer. And we know that lapatinib failed in second line and first line in the Titan and Logic studies. And we know that T-DM1 failed in second line in the Gatsby study. That said, I mentioned earlier that patients that are still HER2 positive in second line or third line, if you were to resample their tumor, if anyone's going to drive benefit from another HER2 therapy approach, it's the ones who are still HER2 positive. So if you're going to do it, you want to make sure they're still HER2 driven. And secondly, which I mentioned earlier, breast cancer just tends to be like that. It stays HER2 positive, whereas gastroesophageal cancer, a large component of it becomes negative over time. So you wouldn't want to just blindly be giving anti-HER2 therapy. So I will use anti-HER2 therapies like lapatinib or afatinib in later line therapy. I'd also even use trastuzumab beyond progression, but changing the chemo backbone like to FOLFIRI with trastuzumab, say in second line. And I find that that works very well in patients who remain HER2 positive. So that's not in the guidelines and I wouldn't be recommended, but you asked what I do. And the answer is that I do that for the appropriately selected patient.
I've heard other people say the same thing. How do you define a patient who's HER2 positive? For example, I don't know, do you ever see HER2 mutations?
Yeah, so HER2 positive is that amplification and overexpression, as we talked about earlier. And that's about 10 to 15% of gastric, 15 to 20% of esophageal G junction in terms of incidence. Mutations of the receptor, which can occur on the outside of the cell or in the inside of the cell that are activating, they can occur in combination with amplification, so you'd see both on your next generation sequencing report, or they can actually just be independent without amplification and just be a driver. Those tend to be more resistant to antibodies like trastuzumab, and more sensitive to TKIs, tyrosine kinase inhibitors like afatinib and lapatinib and tucatinib and these newer ones. But it's very rare, like 1% or so of G-junction esophageal gastric cancers will have it.
I was also thinking about trastuzumab deruxtecan, because like in lung cancer, they see a lot of mutants and they respond to this antibody drug conjugates. That's why I was kind of curious about. And then in terms of the other patients, is it a breast cancer kind of definition of IHC 3 plus or amplified more than 2 or not?
Yeah, so the recommendation is to do IHC first, immunohistochemistry. If it's 0 or 1, it's negative. If it's 3 plus, it's positive. And if it's 2 plus, then to do FISH, and the ratio of 2 or higher is positive. That's sort of the standard way to do it. You can get these results because now NGS testing is becoming more frequent with panel testing. You will see it being called amplified by next-gen sequencing too now. So you can see HER2 amplification just by the sequencing of the tumor as well.
So let's talk about your cases. Maybe you can talk a little bit about how you first encountered the patient and some of the issues in management that came up, beginning with your 38-year-old man.
Yeah, so as a 38-year-old guy, and as most patients with G-junction esophagus cancers presented with dysphagia and have sort of the associative factors, you know, Caucasian, Western diet, obesity, diabetes, that kind of a syndrome. And when they were diagnosed, the staged and locally advanced, and so the patient received neoadjuvant chemotherapy and radiation with the cross regimen. The surgery that was done showed a relatively poor response, and so the patient had high-risk features of recurrence. And because of that, the local oncologist sort of extrapolated from the perioperative FLOT data and gave adjuvant FLOT chemotherapy for 4 cycles with the attempt to try and save the patient. Now, as an aside, this is where CheckMate 577 with adjuvant nivolumab would come into play here potentially in the future, but this happened 2 years ago before that study read out. And unfortunately, as is very common, the patient recurred and recurred quickly within 6 months with metastatic lymph nodes. At that point, as we should do, we get molecular profiling. The patient was HER2 negative, microsatellite stable, the PD-L1 score was CPS5, and the tumor mutation burden was low. And this is an instance where the standard of care might be considered to use paclitaxel and ramucirumab. And this is an exact example where I would argue, why would you continue with paclitaxel that they literally just failed recently and also showed that they didn't have a good response to it in the neoadjuvant setting? So this patient was treated with FOLFIRI-RAM as their, quote, second line because their perioperative therapy was considered first line because they recurred so quickly. And this patient was on that therapy for about a year and a half before progression of their cancer, so relatively good control. At that point, because at the time, the approval, and still is as of today, for pembrolizumab and the CPS1 or higher was treated with pembrolizumab, and unfortunately had, as most do, remember the response rate is 13.3%, did not respond, progressed quite quickly after 2 cycles, and then the patient was started on standard of care trifluridine tipiracil. His performance status was preserved despite being in fourth line, and unfortunately here the progression was quite rapid. And at that point, there was really not much option, and the patient was referred to hospice. But this is an example of a typical trajectory of the disease. And the important point there is that FOLFIRI-RAM was quite helpful here in the setting. And in the future, with CheckMate 649, potentially immunotherapy would be moved up sooner in the first-line setting, and because of CheckMate 577, maybe even in the adjuvant setting, after having a poor response to neoadjuvant chemoradiation. But we have to wait for those approvals in the biomarker groups before we do that.
So are you saying then, in terms of, like, if you could rewind it and start all, you know, he presented today, for example, that you might have or would have, if you could access it, used adjuvant nivolumab in him?
I think that I probably would not today until I see the data, as I mentioned, but it is certainly in play there if that's where the approvals come. This patient would have been eligible for the CheckMate 577 study, and they would not have been eligible for CheckMate 649 study because the recurrence was within 6 months as a first-line therapy. Because they recurred so quickly after curative intent therapy, they wouldn't have been eligible for first-line study.
But again, would this have been instead of the adjuvant FLOT?
Right. And I'll point out also that adjuvant FLOT is sort of outside of the guidelines in a way. The guidelines are to say, surveillance here, even though we know there's a high risk of recurrence, we don't know of anything that will change the course of this. the flood is more treating with the heart than with the mind, I'd say.
That's interesting because we haven't really done a lot of surveying about that. Do you think that's pretty common to use adjuvant therapy? And getting back to the idea of nivolumab, what would be the CPS requirements of using adjuvant nivolumab practically based on the trial?
So in the CheckMate 577 study, this was not looked at. All patients were eligible, irrespective of PD-L1. Now, we want to see the breakdown by CPS because it's very likely that the high levels are the ones driving benefit and the low levels may not have any. That's why I'm saying in the meantime, we just have to wait for approvals and see what happens here. And as newer, like GI ASCO is coming around the corner, if they show some of this data to see and to parse out before I commit my patient to a year of Nevo with all of its potential side effects, I want to know it's going to help them. And I want to know what the magnitude of benefit is based on these known subgroups that have completely different sensitivities to the drug.
But your inclination is in general, you'd be wanting to use treatment if you could?
My sense is that this patient with a G-junction cancer like that, that's adenocarcinoma, is the one that's the least likely to derive the benefit from the immunotherapy, unfortunately. If it was a squamous cell tumor, I wouldn't hesitate. If it was an adeno that had a really, really high CPS score, like above 10 or 20, I wouldn't hesitate. But once you get into lower levels, I want to see the data first.
So am I correct in saying that at this point, this strategy has shown a disease-free survival benefit, but it's not mature in terms of survival, and the disease-free survival, I think it was the hazard rate was like 0.69?
That's right. That's exactly right. We're waiting for longer-term follow-up.
So I guess I add this to my list of current controversies about treating now or later, which I count like five of them, osimertinib in lung cancer, abemaciclib in breast, there's all kinds of things going on right now. And I guess this is going to be added to the list because we don't have survival. But yet, based on the kind of disease, and you know, again, I think about lung cancer, for example, you'd be okay using this kind of intervention even with only disease-free survival data.
Yeah, especially in the right patient. There even appears to be a plateau on the curve, about a 10% absolute disease-free survival benefit, which basically means cure. So a higher cure rate, I think that we can refine who we give it to and maybe show that the benefit's even more in the right patient.
Makes a lot of sense. Really exciting, actually. How about your next case?
So the next case is a 71-year-old guy who, again, presents with the typical dysphagia and was found to have a distal esophageal adenocarcinoma. This was some time ago. And at the time, again, also treated with the cross regimen, carboplatin, paclitaxel radiation, and had an okay response with a YPT2N0. Remember, less than 25% of patients with adeno will have a complete response. So this is not atypical. And again, the patient was monitored after surgery, as would be the standard of care. Unfortunately, several years later, the patient recurred both locally and with metastatic lymph nodes. And at the time, 5 years ago, you know, it wasn't really standard to check for MSI high at the time, but we know this and we were doing it and we knew the patient was MSI high tumor, HER2 negative, and had a really high PD-L1 score, 65, and high mutation burden, which again overlaps with MSI high. So all factors that would indicate that immunotherapy would be useful. So the patient was treated locally with standard first line therapy and had very quick progression, faster than what would be typical. Remember, median progression-free survival is about 6 months generally. So this is at 4 months he progressed. And so the patient was treated with pembrolizumab at that point and with MSI-high tumor, had a CR, complete response, and was treated for a year and was doing very well. And so we put on surveillance. And basically, the patient has been without cancer, essentially as if it never happened, for 5 years and counting. And so this is just an example where even though MSI high tumors is only about 2-3% of all stage 4 disease, you do not want to miss this because it can really change their whole outcome.
I'll ask you the same question. That's the number one question I hear from oncologists about lung cancer, amazingly, which is when do you stop a checkpoint inhibitor in a patient who's doing great? How do you answer it for a patient like this?
It's a good question. And so this patient, I have to say, is on a study. I mean, this was 5 years ago before it was approved. But and on the studies, they typically would give it for 2 years and then stop, or 1 year then stop. And so in real life, then what would you do? I do the same. I mean, I have this now, and we've built up a practice now of MSI-high tumors that are cured. And you know, you don't have to continue if they're already stable for a year or two without any cancer. I think you can stop it. And you see the plateaus on the curves there in all of these studies for these MSI-high tumors. They literally can't find cancer anymore in them. So it's obvious if they have side effects, you would stop them. The real question is when they feel great and it's stable, when are you going to stop? I would not treat longer than 2 years. And I've stopped even earlier, like here at 1 year.
Do you use the word cure when you talk to your patients?
The patients who make it to 5 years, I say, as I do with even patients who we were trying to cure in the curative intent setting, I say, this is unlikely to come back, but anything's possible. But, you know, I think for now we're in really good shape. I mean, there's not any other way to say it, but I don't ever use the word cure per se. This is really uncharted land here with these MSI-high tumors.
Let's go to your last case.
All right. So the last case, this is a patient, 61-year-old with rheumatoid arthritis, presented with, again, dysphagia, as is typical, undiagnosed with a G-junction cardiac adenocarcinoma. And on routine profiling, as one should do, the patient was HER2 positive, microsatellite stable, very high PD-L1 expression, and a low to moderate tumor mutation burden. So per standard of care, especially at the time, this was several years ago, the patient was treated with FOLFOX and trastuzumab. They did get neuropathy. My practice is to stop the oxaliplatin after 4 months or 8 doses to limit the buildup of neuropathy in an intermittent strategy with Optimox to add it back in later if and when there's progression. So this patient went on maintenance 5-FU trastuzumab at that point, sort of preemptively just to limit the cumulative neuropathy issue, and was on that for a year before having any more issues. At the time then of progression, the patient did progress, and we were considering resuming the oxaliplatin, but the patient had neuropathy still that precluded it, that sort of built up even despite stopping the oxaliplatin after 8 cycles. So we went to second-line therapy, but when we did so, we re-biopsied the tumor. This came up when we were talking about, do we use anti-HER2 therapy in later lines? And so this patient on repeat biopsy showed their tumor that was progressing was HER2 negative, was low-level PD-L1, and otherwise microsatellite stable. So per standard of care, this patient, because of neuropathy again, and now based on the data and NCCN guidelines, which at the time wasn't in place, but now it is, we use FOLFIRI-RAM, which is our preferred regimen. For 2 years, the patient was stable on this treatment and did very well. So at that point, finally progressed, and then the patient preferred to do oral therapy, and so has been on trifluridine to Puricil to present, and actually responded. So, you know, there is a 5% or so response rate to the trifluridine to Puricil, and I guess we were lucky to have that here. So this is another sort of trajectory of how one would proceed through treatment. And the other point to bring up here, why, say, for example, immunotherapy has not been used yet, is because the patient has rheumatoid arthritis and we have other options. So now, similar to the trastuzumab deruxtecan discussion, is like when you get to the fourth line, maybe next, maybe there's a discussion now to say, okay, the pros and cons here, we don't have much left. And, you know, your cancer is progressing. We know what's going to happen. Now might be the time to say it's worth the added risk of making your arthritis or other autoimmune issues worse. So as opposed to earlier where we've been on other therapies for years without having to even go there, you know, so that's sort of the argument to discuss in this case.
Yeah, as soon as I saw the beginning of the case and I saw the rheumatoid arthritis, I figured out this is going to be about checkpoint inhibitors because that always comes up. But that's really amazing. So this man, is he still on the TAS 102?
Yep, he is. Yep.
Wow. Any tolerability issues?
No, maybe one or two times we'd had to like delay the resumption of the next cycle because the neutrophils hadn't recovered. And that's not uncommon. But other than that, actually, my experience, like I said, we don't use it that much because not many patients get that far along. But when I have used it, I've not had major issues of tolerability with it.
But I think there was some data in colorectal saying that there was a correlation between neutropenia and benefit. I don't know how big of a thing that was, and it's just amazing. Where did he have disease, and what was the nature of the response?
Well, this baseline PET scan that sort of had lymph node metastatic disease, but as progression goes on, he had lung mets, liver mets. He had like real metastatic disease, and so otherwise I would not have considered him any different other than any other patient, and why he responded to FOLFIRI-RAM for 2 years as opposed to the next patient's 4 or 6 months. It's hard to predict beforehand, but unless you try, I guess you won't know.
Actually, yeah, I didn't realize, I didn't even see that, the 2 years. It was 2 year response on FOLFIRI-RAM. He's already over a year with TAS-102. Maybe he's just a responder.
And that's very true. And like we've seen this in these HER2-positive patients and the patients who have really high PD-L1 scores, maybe they just have a better prognosis over time too.
It was interesting how his CPS initially was 50 and then was 2 on repeat. What would you consider on progression here? Would you give him a checkpoint? How bad is his rheumatoid arthritis? Is he getting biologic treatment?
Yeah, this patient was getting treatment, which again is another reason why we would relegate that to later. There are data to show that you can use immunotherapies in this situation, but my argument here would be, why even go there until you have to when you have other better options? And then the other point about changing the PD-L1 score, we've systematically looked at this and published this, and even at baseline, at a snapshot in time, you can biopsy the primary tumor in the metastatic site, and there's a lot of discordance there between PD-L1 score. Usually going from negative to negative usually is pretty concordant, but if you're positive in the primary tumor, half the time you're negative in the metastatic site. And similarly, over time, you also see changes, and it often goes from positive to negative. So your question now, what would I do? We try to check when we can at the time of progression if we're going to use targeted therapy to, again, make sure they have the target of interest there. And so my guess is they'll have at least low-level expression, and we would consider challenging them in the fourth line if and when we need it.
Well, the other thing is I think they're seeing responses to trastuzumab deruxtecan and HER2-low in breast cancer.
Yeah.
So even if he becomes HER2-negative, I mean, since he was HER2-positive, I don't know. Would you think about it?
Yeah, that's a great point. And so there's two things to say of that, is that sometimes patients who were HER2-positive initially and then evolved to be negative, if you follow them, like say at fourth line, sometimes the new progressing disease is now HER2-positive again and would put that in play. And then the second point, as you mentioned, is that trastuzumab deruxtecan seems to have some response even in HER2-low level tumors in breast, and now we're seeing some in colon and gastric. I mean, those are smaller cohorts, and we need to see that in sort of a larger sample set before I really start to buy into that. But the argument there is that there might be some sort of bystander effect as it gets released into the area. And so we'll see if that bears truth, because it's certainly different than what else we've seen with other HER2 therapies where they don't derive benefit in low-level HER2 patients.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Cantonacci, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for the special Oncology Today issue on the oncologic management of gastroesophageal cancers.